Welcome again, friends, to another episode of Talk Sports. I'm your host, Gary Zabinski. I'm here, as usual, with my friend and sidekick, Roscoe. How are you today, Roscoe?
Oh, I'm fine, Gary. Thank you for asking.
Did you make it through the giant thunderstorm?
I made it through the giant thunderstorm. I've made it through the little bit of kerfuffle that you and I have just had before the microphones went on and the tape started running, but that's fine. We'll get through it.
We're like the battling Bickersons.
We're like the battling Bickersons or the battling Bogarts. Do you remember the battling Bogarts?
I don't. Who were they?
Humphrey Bogart was married to a woman who was a minor movie star who had a fondness for vodka, Mayo Methot, and they were famous for going out in public and getting rip-roaring drunk and having big fights and throwing glasses at each other and turning tables over.
Like at the Brown Derby.
At the Brown Derby. She'd slap him across the face and turn the table over, run weeping to her chauffeured limousine.
Well, we've had one or two altercations in public places.
We have.
One in a restaurant once.
It's several. You once slapped me at a steak restaurant, which was then forced to close.
It was in front of the lobster tank at a steak restaurant.
Yes, yeah, and another time.
Audible slap.
It was a loud audible slap and people gasped.
Speaking of gasping, I am just completely exhausted and out of breath from the week we've just had. Not only did we appear at the Taste of Chicago in the Food for Thought podcast tent, which you can listen to on our prior two podcasts, that was exhausting in itself just to do those, but we also spent a weekend with Stephen Sondheim, and we're going to get to something that I had the great privilege to do, an interview with Stephen Sondheim's longtime collaborator, Paul Gemignani, who had put together the Sondheim celebration for the Grant Park Music Festival and the Grant Park Orchestra. And he put together a lovely program, and I was fortunate enough to be able to interview him and the two guest artists that he had. We're going to play a little of that in a little while.
And you did a fine job.
That's awfully nice of you to say. The night before, I had given about a half an hour lecture about the program and Sondheim and the history of the pieces that we were going to hear. I thought that went very well, too.
People were amazed.
Really a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. It was informative. You were poised, well-spoken, good content. Tough crowd, because you have to assume that everyone that shows up to a Sondheim lecture probably already knows everything there is to know about Stephen Sondheim.
So we went to the Sondheim celebration performance as well on Saturday, which was the second of two performances. That is when I did the pre-show interview with these stars. Why don't you tell our listeners what the very special part of Saturday night was?
Oh, my God, it was so thrilling. The very special part of Saturday night is that we got to sit right in front of Mr. Stephen Sondheim.
Himself.
85 years old. He showed up to the concert. And I guess the story was that someone said, we want you to come and we'll send a private chartered plane to pick you up in the morning and fly you to Chicago and watch the concert and we'll fly you back home. So he said yes, but he was never brought up on stage. If you didn't know where he was sitting, you probably couldn't have spotted him. But you know, gosh darn it, Stephen Sondheim. I got to sit right in front of him. That was pretty exciting.
And if you've never been to the Grant Park Music Festival or the Pritzker Pavilion area with the seating, there's a large, giant square area right in the middle of what would be considered the orchestra seating, and that's where they have the sound booth, the mixing booth for the audio technicians. And right in front of that, there's a small space about 6 feet deep and maybe 20 feet wide, and they put two rows of chairs there for VIPs. Well, that's where they sat, Mr. Sondheim. And it's just a couple of feet from the first row of fixed seats, and at one point, I think it was intermission, you sidled over so that you could be sitting directly in front of Sondheim.
I did. This is something that we, you know, hate to be negative, Nancy. One of the disappointments about the night was the weather had been precarious. So what should have been a packed audience was not a packed audience. So we had some wiggle room. And I would have liked for Mr. Sondheim to have seen 14,000 people there that have been at every other time we've done a Stephen Sondheim celebration.
And then what happened after the show? By the way, the show was quite nice.
It was great.
Very fine. It ended on a very high note. I glanced over at Sondheim during the end right after the encore as the bows were happening, and he was clapping lustily and long in great appreciation. Of course, he and Paul Gimignani have been close collaborators and friends for lo these many 40-some-odd right. years. So he very much enjoyed the show. Then we had another special privilege after the show. Why don't you tell our listeners about that?
Well, this was pretty thrilling. We were invited to a very small, private, give your name at the door, we're going to break your legs and not let you in, party with Mr. Stephen Sondheim at the Chicago Athletic Club. Am I saying that right?
Chicago Athletic Associate Hotel. It's called the Chicago Athletic Hotel now, but yes, it used to be an athletic club right
from,
on Michigan Avenue.
From the 1890s.
Across the street from the park.
We couldn't be closer to the park. We're on the second floor in a roped-off area of a beautiful bar. It's like being in an English pub. I expected, you know, I'm sure, like Holmes to be lurking in the corner. And we were told it was only going to be 40 or 50 people. It felt like it was only 20 or 30 people. It was extremely exclusive. Famous people were there. Rick Bayless, the chef, Bill Curtis, me, you.
Bill Curtis was there, indeed. Yes.
And Mr. Stephen Sondheim.
Michael Halberstam.
Writers Theater, who got a chance to talk to him. And we were so excited about the chance to meet Stephen Sondheim, yet so frightened that he would be brusque or unkind or not interested, or that we would say something cliched or stupid. I mean, you know, let's look at Stephen Sondheim has had people stopping him on street corners for 60 years. So he's probably over it. People saying, oh, Mr. Sondheim, blah, blah, blah. So we were nervous and skittish, and he talked to Michael Halberstam and then turned around and left. And he was had left the party by the time they were going to do the introductions and welcome him and thank him. So we didn't have a chance. I had to move out of the way so that he could walk by me at one point. I mean, I was right next, you know, you and I, the three of us, our anonymous producer, we could have patted him on the head. Not a tall man.
Not a tall man. And probably. He and I were wearing matching sports jackets.
You were,
well.
Which would have been an auntie. And I thought about it later. Why couldn't you have said, oh, Mr. Sondheim doesn't want to introduce myself. I gave the lecture before your concerts. Or Betsy could have said, the anonymous producer.
I could have said, hey, dude, nice jacket.
Nice jacket.
And that song would have shown up in his next musical. Yes. Nice jacket.
Nice jacket.
Finishing the jacket.
Finishing the jacket.
But you're right. We both had ample opportunities, but we were not comfortable just walking up to him. And I kept rehearsing in my mind, what would I say? What could I possibly say that could be of interest to him? And, you know, now after the moment is gone, in hindsight, I realize I could have just walked up to him, extended my hand and said, Mr. Sondheim, I just want to thank you for all the joy that you have brought me through all these many years with your music and songs and shows. And it's just a great privilege to finally meet you in person. I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful night. Nice jacket.
And he would have said, get out of my way. I need a cocktail.
There was something about the way he got here and the way he was going back. He didn't stay the night. He was flown in on a private jet from one of the board members who actually paid for the concert. A couple of them put all the money in and paid for this entire thing, this entire program to be created, which apparently was done once before in New York somewhere.
Most of it. One of the suites was, the Little Night Music suite had not been heard previously.
Yeah, and then I think there was some weather issue or some time issue, and they finally said, you know, Stephen, we really have to get to the airport and get you back to New York. Otherwise, we're not going to make it, or the flight plan is going to get cut short. Let's talk a little bit about the program. What it consisted of mostly were a series of musical suites, which were arranged by various orchestrators, and they consisted of Pacific Overtures, Into the Woods, A Little Night Music, Sunday in the Park with George, and Sweeney Todd. And you never knew what you were going to hear. It wasn't like listening to an overture where they play a little snatch of song right. from virtually every part of the show, and then there's like the main love theme or the main song that centers around the middle of it. These were complicated arrangements. You never quite knew what you were going to hear. Now, the orchestra sounded great, and it was beautifully mixed. You could hear every single instrument, every flute, every oboe, every solo violin. They even had solo cellos in the piece. What did you think of these musical suites? Did you enjoy them all? Were you missing? I personally was missing the words.
Yes. Because as brilliant as Sondheim is a composer, he's probably even more brilliant as a lyricist. And his lyric writing is intelligent, it's jaw-dropping, it's unexpected, it's gorgeous. It's often very funny and very witty. And leave out the lyrics was a little bit frustrating. But there are other, you know, how many Sondheim reviews have I seen in the last year? One or two. It's not like I'll never have a chance to see them. So there's that.
And to be clear, the whole program was not just the musical suites.
Right.
It was interspersed with very few, well, a couple of numbers.
Eight songs, maybe?
Seven or eight numbers.
Yeah.
They did Old Friends from Merrily. Everybody Says Don't, an odd choice.
Odd choice.
From Anyone Can Whistle. You never hear that song done anymore. Sooner or Later from Dick Tracy, which I thought she did a fantastic job of, but it's not really from a show. Too Many Mornings from Follies. Again, you never really hear that song. Finishing the Hat from Sunday in the Park. Miller's Son from Little Night Music. The obligatory Send in the Clowns, also from A Little Night Music, and Being Alive from Company. And they finished off with an encore of
Broadway Baby,
also from Follies. So they interspersed it with numbers, and you got a sense and a taste of the lyrics.
Every time I go, and we talk about this every time, the sound is so magnificent in that facility that it's thrilling. So once I got over my disappointment that I wasn't going to hear more songs performed, the music was beautiful. And because I knew all the lyrics, I was able to place the lyrics into what I was hearing.
Yeah.
The Sunday in the Park with George suite was stunning, moving. Little Night Music, also very moving. And then, of course, I mix up things because I'm listening to A Little Night Music, and I'm thinking, gee, when I was 17, I saw this show on Broadway with Glynis Johns in the original production, and then I just saw it a few years ago, and you and I got into a fight about this because I called you from New York, and I said, I can see one show. What should I see? And you said, see the Scottsboro Boys. See that because it won't run long. And I said, I think I'm going to see A Little Night Music because Elaine Stritch is not going to live forever. And you said, then why did you call me? And I said, I don't know. And then I hung up, forgot to turn off my phone. And I went to A Little Night. It was Tuesday when they just started doing 7 o'clock shows. Bernadette Peters, Elaine Stritch, and A Little Night Music. Pretty thrilling, pretty wonderful to see both of them. And of course, it was the last time. It was the last thing that she ever did on Broadway. And then I called a friend during the intermission to Chicago to say, I just want to let you know that I'm watching Little Night Music on Broadway with Elaine Stritch and Bernadette Peters. And it was 7 o'clock curtain, so it was 6 o'clock in Chicago. So as Bernadette, as the bridge is beginning for Send in the Clowns, my phone rings because he's calling to say, how in the hell are you at a Broadway show at 6 o'clock at night?
It's a good thing it wasn't Patti LuPone and Elaine Stritch.
Oh, my God.
You would have been eviscerated.
I know. I was mortified. I immediately turned the phone. It was just no more than one or two rings, but it was unforgivable.
I mentioned that the concert had been paid for in part or in whole by some very generous donors. This concert was sponsored by Perry and Marty Granoff and the Ted and Mary Jo Shen Charitable Gift Fund. And the appearance of Paul Gemignani, Elizabeth Stanley, Alex Gemignani, and their pianist who accompanied them, Ted Firth, is supported in part by Colleen and Lloyd Fry and the Lloyd A. Fry Foundation. I think it's worth mentioning because otherwise this kind of thing would not have happened for free in Grant Park.
Yeah. And we'd just be sitting at home on a Saturday night watching reruns of Lost in Space or something.
So we're going to play the interview that I did with Paul.
Oh, terrific.
And as I mentioned their names, Paul and Alex Gemignani, his son Alex, and Elizabeth Stanley, who was the female singer in the program. And this was done before the second performance the night we were there, the night Sondheim was there. And I had the great good fortune to sit with the three of them and just chat with them for about a half an hour. So let's take a listen, why don't we? Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to see you all here. My name is Gary Zabinski, and on behalf of the Grant Park Orchestral Association and the Grant Park Music Festival, I want to welcome you to the 615 Club Pre-Concert Lecture Series. Nice to see as many of you here this evening on a threateningly rainy day, though I hear that the weather is supposed to cooperate for us this evening for another couple of hours. Yes. And welcome to the 81st season of the Grant Park Music Festival. I'm going to say that again. The 81st season of free music in the park from the Grant Park Music Festival. And tonight's very special celebration of the music of Stephen Sondheim. This year we are honored to have Mr. Sondheim's longtime musical director and conductor of more than 40 Broadway and West End musicals, including every Sondheim show since Follies, Mr. Paul Gimignani. He'll be leading the Grant Park Symphony this evening, a combo of players including Mr. Ted Firth on piano and two very talented performers, Camp Point, Illinois native Elizabeth Stanley and Alex Gimignani. Yes, you sounds familiar. This is Paul's son. Mr. Gimignani has personally put together this program of music tonight, stating that he wanted the composer and the music to be the star of this weekend celebration. Mr. Gimignani has been Sondheim's collaborator on dozens and dozens of projects, and we're thrilled to have the recipient of a 2001 Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement here with us in Chicago today. How about one more welcome to our stage, Paul and Alex Gimignani and Elizabeth Stanley. Paul, I'm going to start with you. What was your first exposure to music as a child? You're from San Francisco originally, right?
Yes. The first thing I remember is Giorgio Tazzi and, I can't remember, Mitzi Gaynor recording of South Pacific.
That's fantastic.
My mother played it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And I was in the music program in all the schools all the time. I didn't make up my mind what instrument I wanted for a very long time, but I was in all the programs, like from grammar school up.
You eventually kind of settled in as a percussionist, is that true?
Yeah, I did.
How did you first get involved in musical theater? You were doing...
I was doing concerts. I was conducting lightweight opera companies in California and going on the road as a jazz musician with singers. And I ended a job in Minneapolis and decided, well, you know, I'm this close to New York, why don't I just go see what that's about? I wasn't going for work, I was just going to go see a city, because being a California boy, I'd never been out of California, except I did go to the Orient with a group once before that. Anyway, I got there, and you sure you have time for this story?
Oh, we've got all the time in the world.
I got there, and I met an actor friend of mine who was in Cabaret, called, his name was Ed Winter. He was the crazy CIA guy on MASH, if you ever watched that program. Anyway, I met the musical director, Hal Hastings. One thing led to another. He offered me the road company of Cabaret, and my thought was, well, that's a good way to get back to California. So I took the job,
and that's how I got involved in the musical theater.
Cabaret blew me away. I'd never seen, the only musical I had seen before that was Ethel Merman walking through a performance of Gypsy in San Francisco's Kern Theater. But and it didn't impress me one way or the other. I like jazz mostly. I still love jazz. And I didn't care for conducting opera much because it was in too many languages, and I have enough trouble with English, so that's how it happened. And then there are a lot of other things happened, but it would take a series.
Right.
But basically what happened in short after that, I'll tell you one short other thing. After I had done, I come back, he called me back to do Zorba, and I said, I don't want to play. I told you, I'm a conductor. I played one show. Okay, I don't want to play. No, well, you take this show and you'll go out on the road with it as a conductor, which I did. Then he called me in the middle of that and said, you have to come back and do this show, you'll meet everybody you ever need to meet in show business. And I said, who's that? And he said, Hal Prince. I said, well, I knew who that was because I'd already worked for him.
From Cabaret.
Michael Bennett? Not a clue. I had no idea who that was. Stephen Sondheim? I don't know who that is. So I said, no.
And this show was Follies, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, which was my first show on Broadway as a conductor.
And did you play, did you drum in the pit?
I played in the pit, and when Hal Hastings went to do another show, he put me up as the conductor, and I stayed the run, and then I never went back. But the funny thing is that, you know, I kept saying no to him, and he said, I'll fire you, and you'll have to come back. I said, well, I'm not coming back as a drummer. And so I called all my friends that I knew in the music world, and they said, what is the matter with you? Are you crazy? Get to New York. So that's what I did.
And the rest, as they say, is history.
More or less.
Elizabeth, I want to ask you, how does a lovely, talented young woman like you get from Camp Point, Illinois, all the way, keep going, sparkling, dazzling,
good job,
enigmatic, get all the way from Camp Point, Illinois to Broadway musical On the Town? You're currently in On the Town, are you not?
Yes, that's
the
right.
The revival on Broadway.
Yeah.
Tell
not
us
tonight.
A little bit.
Not tonight.
Not tonight. Really? You've called yourself in for tonight? Tell us a little bit about that journey and how you arrived in New York and how you've gotten to the pinnacle of success that you have at this point.
Well, I was always interested in music when I was a small child, and my mom especially was also, so she was very great about saying, oh, I think you might be into that and might have some talents in that area, and so I started taking piano lessons when I was about 6, and like every kid, I hated it. But then I got a really mean teacher, and I was really scared of him, and so then I started liking it, because I wanted to impress him and be able to play the hard stuff. And I was always really interested in singing, too, and I started doing things at the community theater in Quincy, Illinois, which is about 30 miles from Camp Point. And I met my voice teachers there, and then I thought that I would do opera because I really didn't know any professional artists other than my voice teacher at the time, who was a professor at Millikan, and she has an opera career, and she had met her husband when she was playing in Europe, and that sounded very romantic to me, so I thought, okay, I'm gonna do that. So I went to Indiana University, and I was a voice major there, and then while I was there, I became good friends with a lot of the people who also did theater. And I had done a lot of theater growing up. I just thought, I didn't really know how that worked. I didn't really know, honestly, that you could make a living doing that.
Sometimes you can't.
Well, I'm still wondering. so they convinced me to come over to the dark side and step away from the strictly classical musical side. And, and then I guess the rest is history. Yeah, my friends were moving to New York, so I moved to New York, and here I am now.
Are you enjoying being in On the Town?
Yes. It's an awesome experience to get to do it, and has a fabulous score, and we have a really lush, great orchestra.
I haven't seen it, but I saw their number on the Tony Awards, and it was thrilling. It's just thrilling, and it makes me want to go for sure.
Good. Yeah, I didn't do any of the dancing that you saw on the Tonys, but okay. But they are worth watching, yeah.
Alex, I want to ask you, you've become a performer, a composer, and a musical director in your own right with a stunning list of credits and achievements. I couldn't be more impressed with your body of work up to this very young age, as far as I'm concerned. What's your favorite, most satisfying type of work in the musical theater world these days?
Well, I mean, it's a really hard question. I think part of the reason I like to do so many different things is I love the art form, and I love it from every angle. And even the things I can't do particularly well, that I don't do professionally, like set design or dancing, or I have a deep respect for what these people do, and I love the collaborative element of musical theater. I've always loved that. I don't really think you can have a successful piece or career in the musical theater without that level of collaboration. So that's kind of not what you asked. I think I don't really have one favorite. I think it depends. If it's a project that I'm an actor on, I just try to be an actor on that project. If I'm working as a vocal coach, I try to just be a vocal coach in that moment. And if it's something I'm writing, I try to just be a writer. But they all kind of feed into each other all the time. So it's one thing helps something else or uncovers a question about something else. And I love the information you can get, especially from somebody like Steve Sondheim, the information he gives you with his music and his lyrics, how it's constantly a discovery and constantly a collaboration with him, even if he's not sitting there.
And you're allowed to call him Steve?
Yes. In fact, if I call him Mr. Sondheim, he gives me a grumbly look.
Really? Only on special occasions.
Really? Well, perhaps tonight is one of them. But Paul, let's talk a little bit about your collaboration on the Sondheim shows. What are some of the particular challenges, opportunities, or joys that a musical director faces when working with Mr. Sondheim on creating and crafting his shows?
Not getting fired. No. I'll tell you, the most exciting thing about working for Steve, and the first time I heard his music, the first thing I ever heard he did was Company, that I was aware of, that he'd done both words. That's the first show I ever heard. I couldn't believe it, because it didn't sound like a Broadway composer. It sounded like, I don't know what. The thing you'll notice tonight, and is, it's like working. I can't count the shows, let's say 8. Shows with him, 9 shows, I don't remember. The only show I have not done of his is Forum. So I don't know how many shows that is. Whatever, it's like working for that many composers, different composers. Because he writes to character. He doesn't write songs, he doesn't write tunes. Now when Gershwin was writing, and even Richard Rodgers, that's what they did. They wrote tunes, because they had to. Because that's how they made their money. The theater music wasn't making them any money. You know, the songs were making money on Tin Pan Alley. Steve came up from a different place, even though he was mentored by those people. He writes the character, he writes the song that goes fits best with that character in that scene at that moment. So when you hear these suites tonight, which is one of the reasons we wanted to do, and I've got to give Marty Granoff, who's a very rich man who loves music, a lot of credit, because if it wasn't for him and a man and wife named, if it wasn't for Marty Granoff and Perry and Ted Shin and Mary Lou, this concert would not exist, because they paid for the whole thing. I don't mean tonight here, I mean we've done this one other time without the Voices in New York at the Philharmonic, and they paid for that concert. Anyway, the point is, the reason why I thought it was a great idea is because it shows how different. It's like going to a concert and you'll see, and hearing 16 different composers. Now, in tonight's concert, I don't know whether you know this, but I'll tell you. I'm pretty sure it's in the program now. If there is this an insert in your program? It's about orchestrators?
There is an insert this
year. Okay, fine. Last night it wasn't, and I explained to the audience, the orchestrator, in the only two people in the musical theater that did their own orchestrations that I know of, and I could be wrong, Bernstein and Gershwin. And they didn't do them all, but they did some of them. Porgy and Bess, for instance, Gershwin orchestrated. And if you ever go to the Library of Congress, you'll see an example. It's mind-blowing. Anyway, blah, blah. All these pieces will sound different to you, like they're different composers, because that's the way he writes and where he comes from as a writer. Some people say, well, is it the music first or the lyrics? I don't know. But all I'm telling you is, Into the Woods doesn't sound like Sweeney Todd, Night Music doesn't sound like Forum, and I mean really doesn't sound like it. Julie Stein is one of my favorite composers. A lot of his stuff sounds the same. Bells Are Ringing, Gypsy, you can find places in it. Sometimes much more difficult, not to mention trying to understand the lyrics, because they're poetic, they're like poems, and they're whole scenes. If you listen to some of the songs tonight that these guys are doing, you'll see that they're scenes as much as anything else.
I know you two have to go very shortly, but I have a couple more questions for you. It says in your on your resume and on your website, Elizabeth, that you play the tuba. Is this true?
It is true.
Have you always played the tuba, or did you learn how to play the tuba for a particular part that you were working on?
I played oboe in my junior high and high school concert band, and that I really wanted to be the drum major. And so I wanted to be in marching band, and the double reeds aren't marching instruments, and so things like bells that I thought would be cool to play were already taken, and so my band director said, well, no one's playing the tuba. And so I said, great. And it's actually, especially compared to the oboe, probably the easiest embouchure to take up. And you know, it was just a lot of bump, 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 bump. So it wasn't really that challenging for me. It's not like it was some big accomplishment. But yes, it ended up being really helpful then when I made my Bravo debut in a Sondheim show, which was Company in that particular production.
I saw you in that production, yeah. and you played the tuba for absolutely. And I thought perhaps you had just learned the tuba for that part, but.
No.
When you were auditioning, were they looking for...
I carried it up many a hill.
Yeah, were they looking for actors and actresses who played a musical instrument? It was Mr.
Doyle.
Who strictly doubled
with oboe and tuba.
Yeah.
I was the only one going to get it. They were looking for...
It's quite a niche, by the way. It's niche acting.
They were looking for actors who played instruments, and I'm fairly certain I was the last person cast because my instruments were not like essential to the orchestrations of that show.
Well, I found them to be so, and you did remarkably well. I know you guys have to go again. Another question for you, Alex. So growing up with your father here, I presume that you had very early exposure to Mr. Sondheim, Steve, and his music. What's the earliest memory you have of him, and what was childhood like in that household full of music all the time?
I mean, I have a lot of great memories of growing up around going to work with Dad. You know, like, it didn't really occur to me that it was out of the ordinary until I was a little older, and you were talking to friends about what their parents did, and they were like, what is that your dad does? And I would have to explain to somebody what a conductor is and what a music director does. And, you know, if you don't have any experience going to the theater or the opera or the symphony, or you don't really know what that is. And it's when you're in fifth grade, it's much harder to explain. But I listened to a lot of different things growing up that were influenced by my dad and my mom. And you know, my mom was doing a lot of opera growing up, and my dad was doing musical theater. And my dad was a fan of jazz and like Blood, Sweat, and Tears and, you know, things like that. So I was getting this really well-rounded musical education without even knowing. What I wasn't doing was actually listening to the popular music that my peers were listening to. So I still have like a pretty big gaping hole of like 80s music. I don't really know any 80s music. But the strongest memories, I would say, because the first show I ever saw, and my dad can correct me on this because this is as far back as my memory goes, was Dreamgirls. I think, and I remember sitting in the box. That's right, yeah. And I don't really remember the show. I love the show now. I've listened to the album many, many times. But I just remember watching my dad because I was like, that's cool. But as far as like remembering a show, I saw the original Into the Woods probably 40, 50 times. I mean, I would go in with my dad, and I was short enough still to stand on the podium next to him, so I would watch the show from there, or I would watch from the back of the house with the sound guy. Back in the days, you know, now it's all little speakers that are this big, but back then they had in the what used to be the Martin Beck, it's now the Al Hirschfeld Theater, was a huge... like huge speaker in the back left corner that they used for all the Giants sound effects. If you know the show, there's a giant in the second act, and
terrible Giants,
big tall terrible.
Thank you.
I would sit on it during the second act because it was all the sound effects. It was like being at Universal. I met Steve at a very young age, and then as I grew up, as I got, when I got to be about a teenager, I was heading towards to be a trumpet player. So I was always listening to musicals and, you know, involved in them because of my dad, but I wasn't going to pursue that. And then I got to college and thought, oh, I won't be a musician. I'll be an actor because it's a much easier career path.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, sure.
Very wise.
Know, yeah.
I bet Dad was thrilled with that.
He was. I think the exact response was, okay.
Quickly, last question for you. So what's your favorite Sondheim show? And what's your favorite Sondheim song?
My favorite Sondheim show is Sweeney. My favorite song, I will only say this with the caveat that if you asked me in an hour from now, it would be a different answer.
Without question, that? I feel exactly the same way.
Then I would say my favorite song, I'm going to say My Friends from Sweeney Todd, because of all of the things it does. It does, I'm a huge fan of economy in writing. I try to remind, when I write songs, I try to remind myself, it's why Julie Stein is a great composer too. You know, My Friends has such economy of, there's not a wasted rhythm or note or anything in it, and yet it is rich and complex and harmonically like so gooey and so good. And where these two characters are in the piece and how they're communicating and how Steve is communicating about these characters, it's operating on so many levels that it's one of the few things I can't not listen to all the way through. You know, I have to, like, you know, do the whole thing. When I
Elizabeth, same question for you. What's your favorite Sondheim show? You might want to switch microphones.
I'm not.
Oh, it's not.
Hey,
and what is your favorite Sondheim song?
Again, it's impossible to choose, but in this particular moment, I was like, Company is my favorite show, just because it's very sentimental to me, and it's because of having performed it, I've probably know it the best of all of his shows. So at this moment, that's really a special one to me. My favorite song, it's so impossible, but I'm going to say Move On from Sunday. I love the lyric, I love the melody, I love the sentiment, and it's a role I'd like to play one day, so I guess it's on my mind.
Oh, you'd be excellent in that part.
Thank you.
It's about 20 after, and I know that you have to go get yourselves vocally prepared over there, so I'm going to let you two go. Perhaps Paul can stay with us for another few minutes. How about a nice, warm round of applause for Alex Gimignani and Elizabeth Stanley? Thank you. Some last-minute notes here. Be good, I think, was the...
They can't be anything else.
They cannot be anything else. I've seen them all week in rehearsal, and each performance was better than the next. You touched upon this a little earlier, Paul, but I want to ask you a little bit more in detail. Talk about the musical suites we're going to hear tonight, and particularly the orchestrators and arrangers who are responsible for putting this music together, because I know that Mr. Sondheim is always very, very appreciative and complimentary, not only to his musical director, but also to his arrangers.
The reason why, I just want to go say one thing I didn't say last night, the reason why musical theater people or composers do not orchestrate their own material is there's no time. When you're putting a show together, it's not sitting in a room, you know, writing the song and not going to rehearsals and then orchestrating the show. You have to be there. You have to be there and make changes and be involved in the rehearsal process. So it's impossible. Anyway, the first suite is Pacific Overture Suite. You'll only hear the first prologue and opening of that suite because of time factor in this concert. You'd be here on Tuesday morning if I played everything I wanted to play. The hardest thing about doing a concert of somebody like Steve, is what to leave out. It's really hard. Anyway, William Brown, who also orchestrated Miss Saigon, which is the only thing that popped into my head just now, he's done hundreds of other stuff, orchestrated that. This brilliant jazz trombone player, you may or may not know, he's an older guy now, has done thousands and thousands of orchestrations that you wouldn't be aware of. His name is Don Sobeski. I don't know whether you know him or not. He did Into the Woods Suite and he did the Sweeney Todd suite you'll hear tonight. He has never orchestrated a Sondheim show. He just did this symphonic album with these suites on it on his own. And they're great. The Sunday suite, which was premiered at the New York Philharmonic concert, is done by Michael Starobin, who orchestrated Steve Assassins and Sunday in the Park. The premiere tonight here is the Little Night Music Suite, which was written by Jonathan Tunick, who has done not only most of Steve's shows, but every other song you will hear on the show tonight that isn't a suite, he orchestrated. And they're all brilliant. Lots of people say orchestrators are people who can't compose. That's not true. Orchestrators have a calling. You know, musical arrangers are very necessary in this business. They have a calling. And these guys have made a great living at doing this, but they're all brilliant still to this day. And just to tell you a little bit about how it's put together, they go have a conversation with Sondheim. Sondheim talks about what songs he would like. They talk together about what to leave out. We can't put every song in a show in a suite. It's silly. And then they, because Steve is what nobody's mentioned here tonight, Steve is one of the most exquisite collaborators you'd ever want to meet. I mean, I was a young drummer from California when I met him. And I'm telling him what I think. Yes, that's who he is. That's why he's still writing. That's why he's still open. He loves young people. He's open to any suggestion. He will try anything. He doesn't care. He will say, no, we're not doing that, but he will also let you try something that you created, that you have a thing that his creation led you to. So it's a pretty extraordinary thing. It seems like nothing on the surface, but most composers that I know and have worked for say, this is the way it is, this is the way you do it, do it. It's not about what I feel or what I can, you know. So they go and have this conversation with him, and then they have free form to do what they want with this music. He doesn't come back and say, I don't like that way you did that. No, free form. Whatever comes out of their creative pen is what goes on that stage. And that's really trusting and beautiful. And a very secure artist, I might say. You know, but that's the way they pretty much were put together.
How proud of you are you of your son, Alex, somewhat following in your footsteps in the business?
I get asked that question often, and I'll tell you my honest answer. It is such a relief to be able to recommend and have somebody in the family that's talented and not the other way. But I'm so very proud of him. I mean, the thing is, he can do much more than I can do. I mean, he plays trumpet, he plays piano, he plays guitar, he's a composer, he's an actor, he can direct, he can do my job. I have to keep him on a concert series so that I don't get put out of a job.
I was going to say, you've got job security is very difficult.
No, I'm very proud of him, and he's what I'm really proud of is how people see that talent and how they respond to him because he's really a sincere, wonderful artist. Both of these people are. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this concert is not to present, there's nothing wrong with the names I'm going to say, so don't get me wrong, not to present Patti LuPone or Bernadette Peters or Renee Fleming or whatever, to present what is coming up the track. Because in the old days, people used to write shows for these kind of people. That's been long gone. Since Merman stopped singing, that was gone. So young people like this who really are talented and they really struggle. Nobody writes a show for them. They should, but they don't. Doesn't work that way anymore. So I love to have, I always push to have young good people out singing the songs so that all of you can get to know them, maybe, because the other way that you used to get to know them doesn't exist anymore. That's all.
Finally, I know you got to get to work in just a minute. What show or shows would you like to work on that you haven't had the opportunity to do?
None come to mind. I mean, Gypsy was my favorite. I would like to do Funny Girl. I love Julie Stein. I would love to do Funny Girl, basically because there's a lot of people around now that could do Fanny. And Streisand's old enough, so that isn't in your face anymore. Well, you know what I mean. I mean, yeah. You know, she puts her stamp so hard on everything she does, so that was a real hard stamp. It doesn't have a very good book, so the book would have to be real. You'd have to start from scratch, but it's the one musical that I wouldn't mind doing Forum before I give all this up, because it would be, then it would complete my Sondheim canon. But Funny Girl, I think, would be it. I can't think of anything else.
Well, it would be a joy to see you do it and watch you conduct Funny Girl. Thank you, Paul, for your time and attention. Paul Gimignani, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so very, very much. Real pleasure. And thank you all for coming to our Club 615. I hope you enjoyed this journey through Sondheim's body of work. Thank you for being here at the pre-concert lecture, of course, and we hope to see you at many presentations and lectures in the future. I'm going to leave you with this from Stephen Sondheim. Musicals are plays, but the last collaborator is your audience, so you've got to wait till the last collaborator comes in before you can complete the collaboration. Now go out there and be collaborators. And thank you for your time and your attention. Good night, everyone. Well, that was thrilling. I was so happy to have spent some time with Paul and Alex and Elizabeth. You were there. You enjoyed yourself?
Yeah, it was thrilling. You did a great. I was so proud of you. You did a great job. You know, I talked to people around me. I had no idea that I knew you. And they said, oh, that was so interesting. It was so great. I was so glad I came. So you did a bang-up job.
That's awfully nice of you to say. And Paul, as you said at one point that night, he has worked with Sondheim for so many years, and Sondheim has such a giant body of work that it's difficult to pick out exactly what are you gonna leave out. As Paul has said in this interview, it's not just what are you gonna put in, it's what to leave out.
Right.
Something's gotta go.
Right. You probably have 40 hours worth of good songs to work with. So how do you cut that down to 2 hours?
Yeah, these orchestrations were really fantastic. And Paul was in such control of that orchestra that night. I was so pleased to have been there. And yeah.
I got a little weepy at times. Did your eyes get moist? I got a little weepy during Sunday in the Park with George.
Well, Move On always kind of leaves a lump in my throat. Yeah. Always. And as you said, we're so familiar with the works that I was saying the lyrics in my head as these suites were going on. In fact, I mentioned in the interview, or I mentioned the night before during my pre-concert lecture that during, Into the Woods, please feel free to sing along, because I know people are singing along in their heads, and I bet there were some people who, under their breaths, were going, into the woods, you have to go, mm-hmm. into the woods, be careful, move on.
Yes.
But it's always very moving.
Yeah, very moving.
And I mentioned how exhausted we are, because also earlier that week, we had been at the Taste of Chicago doing our podcast in the new Food for Thought podcast and conversation tent, and we did it twice. And after our first podcast, our producer took us to her absolutely favorite restaurant called Aconto, and that's at 18 South Michigan Avenue, right very near the park, just down the street from the Art Institute, just across the street from the Pritzker Pavilion. It could not be a more ideal location, right in the heart of everything. And it's a marvelous Italian food restaurant, Italian with a little bit of a flair to it. It's it's got great imagination to all of its dishes. And it's a great place to hang out and run into friends, old and new. You'll always probably find someone you know in there. I have the menu selections for their dinner here, and just going to run through a couple of them. They have a duck egg spaghetti with a creamy pork sugo and caramelized onions and rapini. Wow. Sounded fantastic. English pea fagottini, which I think was your favorite, with almonds, mint, breakfast radish, and spring garlic burro bianco, and a lobster and corn ravioli. Now, that I almost had that, but I after being at the Taste of Chicago, I could not possibly put lobster and corn ravioli in my stomach. I was just way too full. But it's on my list for things to have the very next time. They also have a roasted whole branzino. A branzino is a fish from, I think, the Pacific. Braised in kale, chili, golden raisins, and agro dolce. Wonderful food. I can't recommend Acanto more highly.
Let's talk about the setting. It's also a lovely restaurant with beautiful indirect lighting. And
big, tall windows right on Michigan Avenue.
No, I mean, I felt like a movie star.
A small room.
I was to the manor born during the few minutes that I was allowed to eat there before going back to my life of penury and neglect.
And previous to Acanto, it was a restaurant called Henri. The same basic room. They haven't changed it all that much, but they've redone the lighting a little bit. They redid the floors to give it this rustic Italian feel. Owner Billy Lawless owns the place. He owned Henri. Mm-hmm. Now he's changed it and he's made it Acanto. He also owns the place next door called The Gauge and another place in, I don't know, Bucktown or somewhere like that called The Dawson, which we've not been to, but we've been to The Gauge very often. Well, owner Billy Lawless has given us a $100 gift card to raffle off to our listeners. Can you believe that?
Wow.
Yeah. If you subscribe to our podcast via iTunes, Android, or RSS and sign up for our email A-list, just look for the A-list, we will enter you in a raffle, which will be held on August 15th. That's about a month from now, in which we are going to raffle off the $100 gift card to Acanto. It will get you and your guest a lovely, lovely meal in one of the hottest, best restaurants in Chicago. So you can sign up for our email A-list on our website, which is www.talksportscast.com.
It's the cast that throws me every time.
You got to put the
and
cast
it's
in.
It's a .com, not a .net.
Not a .net, not a .org, not a .edu, but we're going to offer that as a raffle prize, the $100 gift card. So go to our website, sign up for our A-list on the email A-list.
Now, I'm assuming I am not eligible to win.
The employees of Talk Sports are not eligible to win.
Shoot.
You know what? I'll take you to Acanto someday.
Will you?
For your birthday.
Our producer took us, which I deeply appreciated.
That was a wonderful meal.
It was.
Yeah, and we deserved it after that.
We did. Next day it was back to the dollar menu.
Hey, I thought we might close this podcast as we usually do with a little Kiss of Death segment.
My favorite.
You ready for that?
I am. I'm all ears.
I have a little bit of a short thing to go through here. Some obituaries include a lovely narrative about someone's personal life. We've read many of those. Some include humor and sass, and some, well, they like to be simple and to the point. One North Dakota newspaper may have just printed the shortest obituary of all time. The Forum of Fargo Moorhead in North Dakota printed an obituary for local resident Douglas Legler with two simple words: Doug died.
Is that it?
Legel's daughter, Janet Stoll, told the paper that he said over and over, "When I die, I want my obituary to just say, Doug died." As you can tell, Doug was a very lighthearted and funny man. Needless to say, Doug Legler is having the last laugh. This wasn't the first time someone wanted to have the last laugh. Here's another obituary. Simon was born in Manzano, New Mexico. Simon Romero passed away on August 11th. Simon leaves behind five ex-wives, 30 or more children, and his wife, Dolores. I thought it was funny at the five ex-wives, but then 30 or more children. Here's another one. Larry Darrell Upright passed away at the ripe age of 81 back in April in Northeast Concord, Florida. He was a member and past master of Alan Graham's 695 Masonic Lodge. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be sent to Shriners Hospital for Children on Point Drive in Tampa, Florida. Also, the family asks that you do not vote for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. R.I.P., Granddaddy.
Good Lord.
Now, here's something I do want to read. You worked in radio for some period of your career, and at one point you worked on and developed, well, a long documentary, may I say documentary, mm-hmm. radio documentary, about the late, great John F. Kennedy. Did you not?
Yes, it was actually about the assassination.
The assassination itself.
Specifically.
Right. Yeah.
It was for the 25th anniversary of his assassination, which it takes us back to 1988. Which might lead you to understand that I'm not a spring chicken.
Spring chicken is also on the menu at Aconto.
Yes, spring chicken with English peas.
Gary Mack, a Dallas broadcaster whose fascination with the Kennedy assassination led him to become a widely consulted expert on the event and eventually the curator of the Sixth Floor Museum, which is devoted to the assassination, died on Wednesday in Arlington, Texas. Mr. Mack, like many Americans of his generation, stayed glued to the television set as the events of November 1963 unfolded. His interest was rekindled after seeing the Zapruder film, footage of the assassination on television in 1975. I didn't realize that it had been 12 years before they showed the Zapruder film on television. Yeah, is it something that you were aware of?
Can I talk about that right now?
Of course, absolutely.
Here. The exhibit number one in the assassination of President Kennedy was the Zapruder film, which was the actual home movie of President Kennedy being shot. Here's what happened. Abraham Zapruder filmed it. It was shown to some law enforcement people, the FBI, and the sole journalist who saw it was Dan Rather. Then it was considered, think about this, if an assassination happened today, God forbid, you can't even think about that. Of course, no one wanted this footage to be shown in 1963. It would have been much too horrifying to show this on television. Life magazine actually purchased the rights and then locked the film up. And even the Warren Commission never saw the film. All they saw were drawings of individual frames. Dan Rather saw the Zapruder film, then went on television and talked about what he had just seen. And what he said did not match what is seen in the film. So the thought was, did he lie about this? Did someone pay him? You know, was he threatened? Why would Dan Rather give an inaccurate assessment of what he had seen?
Do you recall what he said?
Well, it had to do with the movement of the head. And clearly, if you see the film now, you think he had to have been shot from in front and behind because of the way that his head snaps. Dan Rather's explanation is simple, that he saw it once. It was so horrifying that it was difficult to even comprehend what you were seeing. And he made a mistake because he was so overwhelmed by what he had seen. This was in 1975. Then of all people, the first time it was broadcast, you know this story?
No.
Geraldo Rivera had an evening show on ABC after the 10:30 news. Called America Tonight, and he got his hands on the Zapruder film and took a lot of guts to show that on television. But nobody in America, for 12 years after the assassination, no one saw that film.
Interest became an obsession for Gary Mack. We're talking about Gary Mack now, not Gary Zabinski, yours truly. Interest became obsession when he began working in 1981 as an announcer, cameraman, and local news producer at KXAS-TV. A local NBC station, this is still in Dallas, where part of his job was to manage and preserve the station's film archives and its coverage of the assassination and its aftermath. As he pored over the historical record, read every account of the assassination he could lay his hands on, and inspected the footage frame by frame, he developed an impressive command of the subject. Mr. Mack became a valued resource for historians and documentary producers. Now, you never interviewed Gary Mack when you were preparing the radio.
I think I did. Uh-huh. I think I talked to him, at least, and he may have referred. I think he wrote a book with a man named Jim Mars, who also was involved with the museum.
We're not going to have one person that knows that much about the assassination and all elements and all roads leading everywhere, Hugh Ainsworth, a former reporter for the Dallas Morning News, told KERA, the local public television station. Gary was the man, he says. Mr. Mack was born Lawrence Allen Dunkel in 1946 in Oak Park, Illinois.
Whoa.
Earning a degree in journalism from Arizona State University in 69, he worked for a variety of AM and FM radio stations as a disc jockey, music director, and program director. Looking for a catchier on-air name, he came up with the name Gary Mack.
Wow.
Which bears no resemblance to Lawrence Allen Dunkel, but it's pretty easy on the ears for radio. In Dallas, he first became known as a Kennedy assassination conspiracy theorist, with some eye-catching finds to his credit. In the 70s, he discovered that a Dallas police officer on duty on November 22, 1963, had left the microphone on his radio switched on, and that the audio material had been transferred to tape at police headquarters. The background sounds on the tape, which Mr. Mack obtained from a retired police officer, suggested to him that a fourth shot had been fired by a second gunman from the grassy knoll. That theory, which members of the House Select Committee on Assassinations found persuasive, was discounted by researchers at the National Academy of Science, who concluded that the popping sounds were electronic noise, a finding that Mr. Mack accepted only grudgingly. He started out as a pretty vicious conspiracy theorist when he was with Channel 5, said Mr. Ainsworth, who witnessed the assassination and the ensuing events. He eventually settled on what might be called conspiracy light. That is, he doubted that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone and believed at least that there was more to the Oswald story than we know, but shed the more lucid hypothesis in favor of scientific detachment. What was the conclusion of your documentary, Roscoe?
We didn't have one, and I'm in alignment with what he said. And there was a famous researcher, Harold Weisberg, who spent years of his life trying to dig into this. His conclusion with the Kennedy assassination was Oswald probably didn't do it, but the important lesson from it is that all of our institutions failed us. The police failed, the FBI failed, the Secret Service failed, journalists, the media failed. And they never got to the bottom of what exactly happened. So there's no way that anyone... I have 50 books in my basement on the Kennedy assassination. I have 40 hours of tape that I spoke to everyone in the world about the Kennedy assassination. You can't make a leap from what evidence there is to a conclusion, unfortunately. Well, so there's always... And I'll tell you, the year I worked on that was... I had nightmares about the Kennedy assassination.
Really?
The cast of characters is huge. The possibilities about who done it are large and complicated. And just trying to keep it all in your head and keep all the strings straight, very, very difficult. And every once in a while, something leaks out that we didn't know previously. What that tells us, I don't know.
Yeah, most recently, Mr. Mack had obtained 8mm film from Tina Towner Pender, who as a 13-year-old stood near the motorcade just seconds before shots were fired, and still photographs were taken by her father, Jim Towner, who was standing with her. Have you ever heard about these photographs?
No.
It's interesting. The mystique of the assassination and the unsolved questions surrounding it held him in a tight grip. I'm personally convinced there's more than just one Oswald involved, but I can't prove it. And neither can anyone else, which goes along to about what you were just saying. Gary Mack died at age 68, fairly young man.
Yeah, can I tell you just two other things that I think are kind of interesting?
No one ever lets you talk.
No one ever lets me talk. We always talk about how we knew that there were three bullets fired. You know why the reason we know there was a third bullet? Because there was a bystander who was actually grazed by a bullet.
I've read about
this. Yeah, and the Warren Committee, they couldn't pretend that it didn't happen. I think his name was James Tague, and he discredited himself later because he apparently the bullet ricocheted off the curb and grazed his ear, and as he got some publicity for being, you know, someone who was almost killed by the assassin, the bandage on his ear grew larger and larger. As he attempted to look like more of a victim than he really was. But, you know, there's crazy things that happen. The There's a building across the street from the Dallas School Book Depository where Oswald allegedly shot. Only 10 or 15 years ago, someone was working on the roof and came upon shell casings that had slipped under some shingles. Now, were these shell casings connected with the Kennedy assassination? Maybe. Did the guy just come up with a good story? Maybe. Who knows?
It's one of those things that you'll find out about when you meet your big maker in heaven, as Gary Mack probably found out recently. he's now has all the answers,
Gary,
if you believe in that.
Welcome
kind of
to heaven. We're now going to pull out the big reveal and let you know who killed John Kennedy.
Well, thanks again, Roscoe, for another wonderful episode of Talk Sports. I hope everybody out there enjoyed this one. It's got a lot of different things going on, many varying moving parts to this podcast,
yes.
But I hope that you're satisfied at the end, that you'll have a good time listening. Roscoe, will I see you again soon?
If the Lord don't call me home, if the good Lord is willing and the creek don't rise.
Well, now that will be a kiss of death for the
ages.
That
will be and here's our secret. Here's our surprise kiss of death. Roscoe is gone.
Now, you'll be with us for a very, very, very long time.
Oh,
I can tell by the health on your face.
Ooh.
Take care, everyone. We'll talk to you next time. Bye, Roscoe.
Goodbye.